Hey, welcome to The Forecast. I'm Hemming Nelson.
And I'm Brian Kassler.
And today we are going to talk with Melissa Thompson. She's a senior video producer at Greenpeace USA, and she's got some tips for us for how to make a successful video. And as always, this episode, You Jump the Gun, brought to you by Charity Engine.
If your CRM is driving you to drink, give charityengine.net a call.
And here's our conversation with Melissa.
So my job is senior video producer at Greenpeace, senior because I'm in my now late 40s. No, senior because I'm older because of the other guy. And, you know, it's not really producer like people think of in broadcast. You know, it's actually like when I introduce myself in meetings, I say, I make videos.
Yeah, because you do everything.
I do everything. I'm the one-man band. Okay. Yeah.
And who's your colleague?
Mitch Wankus. Okay. Who's fantastic.
And you guys have both been there together as a team for a while, right?
Yep. Yep. I brought him in during maternity leave and then got him to stay.
Okay.
So. And we're a really good team because he's a fantastic shooter. I can shoot when I have to. I'm a pretty good Verite shooter, but I'm not like one of those camera geeks. But I am an editing geek.
Okay, so you don't look at the B&H catalog every day
for the uninitiated
about what equipment you're going to upgrade to.
What's a Verite shooter?
Oh, so I'm pretty good at like following people around, handheld, you know, kind of shooting on the fly. I don't really like messing with lights and flags and gappers and grips
sort
and
of preparation.
Yeah, it's way too much work. So, no, I mean, I came up, you know, I got most of my experience working on documentaries, following people around, you know, I guess it's all now reality television, but back in the day it was called Verite, Cinema Verite.
Did you go to school for that?
I did. I went to Temple University, okay. Got a master's of FAL, otherwise known as fine arts, and... Yeah, but it was actually pretty great. I loved it.
And how did you end up at Greenpeace?
Well, I got hit by a car, actually, is how I ended up at Greenpeace. I was working in corporate video production, making lots of money, and pretty happy. But I had always been an activist and always been very involved in social activism.
Is this up in Philadelphia?
Yes, yeah, when I was living in Philly, yep. And New Orleans before that. And so I was kind of like working this job, making good money, and then at night and on the weekends making my little radical films about abortion rights or whatever it was. And then I got hit by a car and I almost died. And I was out of work for a while. But it kind of just was that moment where I was like, what am I doing with my life?
Life is short.
Yeah, really short. And I'm not here to... This is not what I'm here for, you know, to make money for corporations. So right around that time, a good friend of mine, Cheryl, you might remember from Rushmore, sent me a job listing for Greenpeace. I applied, and about like a year and a half later, they called me. and I've been here ever since. I started on the same day that Obama started in January of 2009.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You've done a little bit better than he has, I think.
Oh, yeah.
As
my colleagues.
So did you relocate for the job?
I did.
And did you move here knowing anybody already in D.C.? Or was
yeah, I had two really good friends in D.C. So I still miss Philly, though. Good restaurant town.
So what's it like working over there at Greenpeace?
It's pretty fun.
The office Greenpeace party, a couple times, the Christmas yeah. party. If it's anything like that.
Yeah, party every
I'm
day,
not
man.
Sure how you get any work done.
It's intense. I mean, people are extremely committed, and I think it's a fantastic organization. I think like they really managed to stay true to, you know, their independence. They don't take money from corporations or government. It's money from people like you and me. And I think that's very cool. And I think that guides what we do. You know, every time I make a video, I'm like, do I really need to spend, you know, do I really need to shoot this on the red? Could I shoot, you know, like we're constantly looking at our budgets and thinking about, you know, this is people's money. And that's a good thing. Mm. But you asked me something else. Like, how
well,
I like
I've also
working
seen
there?
Like, you know, the office manager's list of companies they can't buy office toner from. And I mean, it sounds like it's to the core. It's not,
it's the real deal.
Well, I always tell people that you guys are one of the most fun organizations I've ever worked for because, you know, it's just the creativity and the out-of-the-box thinking and the embracing the outrageous makes for a lot of fun projects.
We could talk about how we met.
How did we meet?
I think we met in at Mount Rushmore.
Oh, really?
Did we actually meet before then?
I don't remember.
I don't think we did.
I remember when you started.
Okay.
I don't remember the exact circumstances, but the Rushmore thing was really fun. I think there's an arrest warrant still out from Minnesota.
You can't go back to South Dakota.
Yeah. So what was that? What was that Rushmore thing all about? Do you remember?
Oh, you know, there's a big banner off the side of a famous monument. a really big banner.
Yeah, so the communications team over there and the actions team, I guess,
yeah,
engineered this banner of Obama to be unfurled next to all the other presidents and basically challenging him, you know, if you want a legacy like this, you've got to, like, take a bold stand.
On climate.
But it involved a bunch of climbers who climbed up the backside of Mount Rushmore and camped out on top of the mountain overnight and then, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, scaled down the front side. And unfurled this banner. Meanwhile, the Greenpeace had hired helicopters to, like, shoot from the air, and then a team, I don't know, maybe, like, five or six other shooters strategically placed around the park, and I was doing a live webcast in the parking lot. And I was sitting in a car, and when the shit went down and the cops swarmed the place, I just kind of calmly drove out of there. I think I was the only one to get away.
I got away too, not so for one of my shooters.
Yeah.
But thankfully, she had just handed me the it was called tape back then. She had just handed me the tape from her camera. I walked past the police as they grabbed her, and also calmly drove, or not so calmly, drove down the side of the drove down the mountain to
the safe
hotel.
House.
Yeah. Yeah. Although then I think we heard on the police scanner that they were coming to the hotel, so we all jumped into a car, and I think that video was edited mostly in the back of a car.
Yeah, and playing on like CNN that night.
Oh my God,
it's pretty amazing. And so I think that you know, that sort of for me epitomizes, you know, you're going to have a lot of people who are going to hate you for defacing a public monument, but you're going to get on CNN and you're going to make your statement, and there's going to be your core audience out there who's going to watch that and be like, that is great. And even if that's a minority of the people, they're never concerned, or they aren't as concerned as a lot of my clients are about, like, appealing to the broad masses. I mean, you sort of, you know your audience, you're focused. And because of that, your messaging is great. So that may have been my last experience with Greenpeace. I don't know.
Well, it's kind of an interesting sea change in how video is consumed between that experience and nowadays, where you were talking about tape and, you know, you're filming on site, and like literally somebody today could be, you know, flying a drone over a scene, live streaming to YouTube. There's nothing to be confiscated. The video footage is already out there.
Right.
Kind of how has that medium changed the way you approach video for the organization?
Well, I think a good comparison would be this last, we did an action in Portland a couple weeks ago where about 30 activists successfully blocked Shell's icebreaker from leaving Portland for a couple days, which is significant.
Is that the one where they're hanging from the bridges?
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very, very cool. And
those photos got around. Like, yeah. They penetrated my news feed.
Good. Yeah. Fantastic. But, you know, we didn't. So for Rushmore, you know, there was a video. There was all this. We shot all this stuff, and then it all got back to me, and I edited it, and then we put out the video. And that just doesn't work anymore. It has to be sort of in the moment. So we had this great team of local camera people and an editor in Portland, and we had runners, and they were, you know, running footage back to the editing suite. He was uploading stuff. And we were, Mitch and I were pushing out to the news and getting it out to, you know, our distribution lists. And then also we pre-shot some interviews with some of the activists ahead of time so that we could, we knew they were going to be up there for a while if we had any luck. And we needed some content to sort of keep putting out there while they were up there. So we had pre-recorded some interviews with some of the activists, and as soon as a little bit of the footage started coming in, I banged out these videos that were able to be used on social media, and one ended up on the New York Times website, which was a personal high for me. So, wow.
So what are you looking for when you're putting this content together? Like, are you, you know, you're obviously working under the gun, and you can't necessarily plan a lot of this stuff. But are there things you're looking for that you know are going to be popular or are going to catch people's imagination?
Yeah, I mean, I think people tune out when they hear we have to get the campaign messaging in, but if you can pair that with a personal relationship to that campaign messaging, it goes so much further, at least for me. So, for example, there was a woman that we interviewed, one of the activists, Harmony Lambert. We interviewed her beforehand, and she's from Santa Barbara and was talking about the oil spill that had just happened there and how her ancestors had lived in that part of the world for thousands of years and how she really didn't want this to happen to indigenous communities in Alaska, you know, should there be an oil spill in the Arctic. And I'm not doing it justice, but having someone talk about
what a personal stake in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, those stories get me every time, you know, versus, you know, if people are just saying we have to do this and blah, 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 people are going to tune out. But if people can understand, so you see these stick figures hanging off a bridge, but if we have the opportunity to put faces on them and these are like not extremists, you know, they're just people and they have really valid reasons and really personal reasons for taking these huge risks. You know, that's how you win hearts and minds.
So that's obviously, you know, to pull something like that off takes months of planning and lots of resources and stuff. No?
Except for we didn't know about it until about 2 weeks before. I mean,
really?
They didn't gouge their icebreaker until about 2 weeks before the action. So, it happened. The actions team at Greenpeace, I just got to hand it to them. They're absolutely amazing.
But I cannot believe they pulled that off. I guess my point is that takes a big organizational commitment and a lot of moving parts. Are there examples of like smaller actions that you guys have videotaped that have worked out well, just sort of from the video perspective?
Sure. I'm thinking about when the Koch brothers, I can't remember if it was Charles or David, whichever one is the least extreme, the one that like funds the opera and the ballet and all that. And he also funded, I think it was him, the Koch wing at the Smithsonian, the dinosaur wing. So when they opened this wing, we had this protest outside, but it was a very funny protest. So we have an old ambulance and we have some old cop cars that we painted as, God, climate crime scene squad or something.
That's another fun place to go, is the Greenpeace warehouse.
Yes, definitely.
Warehouse? Is this where you keep all... Is it like the Indiana Jones?
Pretty much,
props,
yeah.
The boats, the costumes, the big giant tiger costumes, yeah. But so we had... And we had this sort of like Law and Order-esque detective that showed up and started interviewing just people on the street of, have you seen this guy? And do you know where he is? And, you know, he had a kind of a mugshot of one of the Kochs. And we did this video, totally unplanned. But the guy, his name was Ben Cummings. He used to work at Greenpeace on the frontline team. And he was just hilarious. And what could have been a really kind of strident, in-your-face kind of video turned into a very fun video that was hilarious, you know, where he's talking to the security guards about, you know, have you seen this guy? And, you know, we think that he's funding this wing, but we're not sure. And, you know, did you know that he's responsible for climate destruction? They're just like, is that your car? Could you move your car? You know, like, but because he's interacting with like people who are not scripted, you know, it was very, very funny stuff. And that was just gold. Like, we didn't plan it. It just happened.
Mm-hmm. And you're, the two things you've touched on so far, which is personal stories and making it funny, are kind of two hallmarks of any great video that I can think of,
yeah,
regardless
for sure
of whether it's kind of like a live action video or not. You've given this talk before at American University, so do you have your PowerPoint deck that you can refer to tell us what the third salient point is that in the recipe for making a great video?
Oh, God, I think there was like about 5 points, but I'll be lucky if I remember three. I think another tip would be to make it shareable. So, you know, people share stuff, and this isn't something that per se I like in a video, but it's apparently been researched and it's, you know, quote unquote, a fact. People want to look, they share videos because they want to look cool. So they share stuff that's going to make them look a certain way.
People share stuff they never watch or read.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, you know, obviously strategies like including personal stories, making stuff funny is key, but also like, you know, if you can get a celebrity or, get someone to do the music, or, you know, if you got some cool factor that you can add, that will enhance people's desire to share it with all their friends. That's always good.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's important to know your audience. You might get the wrong cool factor.
Oh yeah. Actually, great point. That was another part of the talk I gave, I think, is that, you know, a lot of times campaigners will say, okay, I need this video. First of all, do you need a video? Like, that's my first question. Is it a video or do you need like an email? Like, it's really like a lot. I think up for a long time, people were just like, I have to have a video because that was the thing. But video is not always like the best tool for getting your message. And so it's really important to ask people like, is video the thing that you need? Could it, or, you know, within video, could it be a Vine? Could it be an could you run a Vine contest? Could you run an Instagram campaign? Does it really have to be a 1 minute, you know, PSA or whatever? But then knowing your audience. So sometimes it's not the viral, you don't need to reach everyone in the world. You want to talk to the CEO of a company. You want to talk to a senator. You know, if that senator sees the thing, if that CEO sees the thing, it doesn't really matter if the whole world sees it, because if you get your chain, if you get, you know, what you need accomplished. So like, so what I'm saying is like, sometimes people get carried away with thinking it has to have a million hits on YouTube. And it, a lot of times it doesn't.
I think that's a really important point. I bet 95% of the people who come to us and request a video have no idea who they're talking to. They just want as many people to see it as they can. And no matter how much you talk to them about what they're trying to get out of it and how it's going to help their organization or their specific campaign, I think that for some reason the message doesn't get through. You know, it's just about like, our audience is pretty much anybody who we might possibly ever give us $5, you know, which doesn't narrow things down and then doesn't let you make a video that is actually funny to a group of people.
Yeah.
It becomes kind of washed out.
Yeah.
And generic.
I mean, it also depends, like, are you talking to your audience, your supporters, or are you trying to bring in new people? And those are two very different videos, you know? So like we have to make videos that appeal to our supporters for certain things. It's really important. We want to, you know, rally our troops and engage the people that support Greenpeace. Super important. But we're not going to survive if we don't bring new people. I mean, literally the planet's not going to survive if we don't bring new people into the issue. So how do you reach them? Sometimes you got to let go of your messaging altogether. And I think that's, for me, that's the biggest challenge.
How does the communication director feel about that when you tell them that you're going to let go of their messaging?
You know, I don't have a problem with the communications director. It's more of a campaigns team, but hopefully they're not listening. It's really hard to translate some of the campaign messaging into communications objectives sometimes.
Do you actually have like a worksheet when one of the campaigns comes to you and says, we want a video?
Yes,
you say the first question is, why do you need a video?
Yes.
And then who are you trying to reach?
Yep. What's your objective? What's the distribution? You know, is it online? Is it a PSA? Are you showing it at a community center? You know, I have a questionnaire. It's a Google Doc.
What's the hardest question for them to usually answer? What's the one thing that I'm guessing, like we were talking earlier about, you know, who's your audience? Like, they didn't really consider who their audience was.
Yeah. It's either that one or what's the distribution method? Because they're just like,
everything.
Let's put it up on YouTube. But it doesn't matter if it's on YouTube unless someone's going to push it. You know, and that's where, like, we work really, really, really closely with the online team. And if we don't have buy-in from the online team on the concept of the video, I'm at the point where I'm like, I'm not making it, you know?
Because they're not going to put it on the front page, and they're not going
right.
to put a link in the newsletter.
Sit on exactly. your YouTube channel yeah. and get 20 views.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's something for people, especially if you work in a smaller nonprofit and you don't have a lot of resources, you need to think really, really, really long and hard about distribution. And there are definitely companies, you know, certainly if you're doing a PSA, you can hire a PSA distributor that will call and fax and email channels around the country and get them to play your PSA. You can also hire companies.
How much does something like that cost?
You know, I only know about a recent PSA campaign that we ran. The money could vary wildly depending on, if you're targeting people in Austin, Texas, it's going to be a certain price. It's going to be much lower than if you want to target everyone in the U.S. So a few years ago, we did a PSA campaign that I think our budget for distribution was about $10,000. And that...
Is that more than the video cost to make?
For that video, no.
Okay.
For a lot of videos, our videos, yes.
So what else is on your questionnaire then?
God, let's see.
Messaging.
Who's your audience? What are your objectives? I mean, objectives is what do you want people to do? I mean, this is just clarifying objectives. What do you want people to do at the end of this video? And you have to give them something to do.
That's a great
There's
point.
No point in making a video unless for just general awareness. I mean, you've got to have, you know, something they can click, preferably probably during the video itself, because they're not going to watch to the end, sadly. So you've got to give them an annotation they can click on to take them to a petition or, you know, give them a number to call their representative, whatever it is you want them to do. You have to tell them.
Is YouTube's your primary method of distribution?
It's,
I mean, basically everything eventually goes on YouTube.
Well, of course, with Facebook promoting video so much, YouTube is kind of taking a back seat. I mean,
really?
We get so many more views on Facebook right now. Because Facebook is favoring if you upload via Facebook, the way they present the video is much nicer than if you put in a YouTube link.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they favor anyone that posts video through Facebook. Yeah.
Just saw today. Have you ever used Buffer app?
No.
Probably not at the organizational level. They have a paid service, but the whole idea is for the average person out there, you might be posting a lot of links to your social networks, but if you're a small organization, you probably don't have the capacity to actually have a real media calendar and keep up on it. So Buffer's idea is you just put in content and it figures out when is the right time to post to your networks.
Wow.
And there's a paid version that offers more options. But what's really cool is they just added a native video upload. So you upload a video to their tool, it will get the native bump through Twitter, through Facebook, and I believe LinkedIn, and maybe a couple other social networks. But if I was a small nonprofit, I would at least, it's free for the kind of entry level service. So I would go check that out. And you get the native bump though. It's not like uploaded somewhere else and then a link in the tweet.
So we talked a lot about, what kinds of things make a good video. When is it not a good idea to have a video? Can you think of any examples of times when you've said, you know what, you might just want to make an infographic or...
Video's gone wrong.
Yeah.
When have you made a video and then not published it?
Oh, God.
Maybe that's another fall. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, no.
You're like, we can't.
It happens
a
lot.
We can't put this one out.
I wish I could tell you about this one video that's sitting on Mitch's desk right now.
Theoretically, if there were a video.
So, okay, I'll try to speak in really vague terms. We do a lot of corporate campaigning where we'll go after a specific company for a specific practice. For example, we have a campaign, Green My Internet, that is working with major tech companies to try to use renewable energy to power their data systems, power the cloud. And so we were going to target this one company who shall remain nameless. And then they opened a GD wind farm somewhere. So, like, and we made this kick-ass video, but it's not going anywhere. Yeah.
You can't just switch out.
That's a good reason that it's not going anywhere, I guess.
Yeah, it is a good reason. Yeah.
Maybe they heard
you. Come to Christmas party and we'll show it to you.
Suddenly cranked up a whole farm.
Yeah, but there's lots of times when campaigns change, you know, and it would be a bad campaign strategy to release a video because something has shifted.
So there's a folder somewhere on your computer of unpublished videos. I love this because they're probably really good too.
I mean, there was also right after Rushmore. Right after Rushmore, we made a fantastic documentary about the activists. Because they were all facing charges.
Jess, was that her name? What was her name?
Jess Miller.
Jess Miller.
We did interviews with all of them, and we interviewed their parents and their families about, like, what, you know, how do they feel about their kids and their relatives doing this? And we kind of went to court knowing that if the charges came back really bad, we would release the video. But lucky for us, you know, except for Matt Leonard, no one was charged with anything. So we never released the video. We made the video, never released the video. Again, a good reason.
Mm-hmm. I think your marketing team needs to have another YouTube channel called Greenpeace Deep Cuts. And explicit disclaimers. You're going to get views.
That's awesome.
I mean, that's unfortunately, that's kind of like confirmation bias that you also see on social networks where even, like, you know, pure satire articles get shared like facts because people aren't really sometimes engaging fully with the content. But you could definitely do it. I feel like, yeah, have some alternate reality Greenpeace site. Post these deep cuts. It's good content.
So what are some recent videos that you're really proud of?
Well, I'm working right now. It's coming out next week on a video called Repower Our Schools. And it's a campaign to get schools to use renewable energy. Make a huge difference. You know, schools, massive institutions, take up tons of energy. Kids could be supporting, you know, those institutions could be supporting renewable energy. Kids could not be missing school because of asthma, which is caused by all of these old forms of energy, coal burning plants. And kids could learn more about science and be better prepared for jobs in the future. I mean, it's a win-win, you know, for kids.
So how did that, what was the genesis of that project?
So the campaign is run out of our Charlotte office, who's, you know, there's a big attack against solar in North Carolina, thanks to Duke Energy. And they wanted to run a local campaign to try to get, and they thought there was some capacity in Charlotte and Durham to get school board officials on board with some kind of resolution to support renewable energy. So I wrote a script, hired some friends of mine, shot it on green screen, and then we got this great high school artist to draw some drawings, which were then animated to go behind the kids. But it's, I mean, anything with kids is gold, right? You know, they just say adorable stuff. And it's so much more interesting, and adults can hear it so much better than they can hear stuff from other adults. So that's a fun
so
piece.
In a case like that, how did you come up with the script? They obviously had things, points they wanted to make, but were they pretty open to you dictating vision was?
Yeah, my kind of take on it was like, let's get kids talking about school and their school and why they love their school and engender sort of school pride. And then we go down the campaign points, you know, but like, why do you, you know, so what
That's
if...
sneaky.
Yeah. Because then like, teachers are going to share it. Parents are going to share it. People that work at the school administrators are going to share it.
100 people who's invested.
So we're going to launch it next week for the back to school stuff and hope that, and there's a great line. Oh my God. One of these kids, she's brilliant. She's like, yeah, we could, because they would actually save money is the crazy thing. If they went to renewable, and that money could be used to pay teachers better because they deserve better, you know? Oh, It's gold.
So I know working with kids can be a problem. Did you, I mean, obviously the legal rights, you had to get parents to sign stuff. Did that complicate it at all?
Not really. I mean, I wasn't on the shoot, so I don't...
Everything was done down in Charlotte?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we have like a pretty awesome field team down there that has a lot of volunteers, and they worked with their volunteers and their kids and stuff to get people, so...
That's the other thing about working with Greenpeace is there's a lot of volunteers and they've got a crack legal staff.
Yes. Yes, we do.
I remember prepping for an action. It was like, here are your rights if you get arrested. This is in your wallet. This is who you call for a lawyer. Repeat after me. This is what you say.
Yep. I mean, you know, it's interesting. It's so great that we have the legal support, because a lot of the times when we're doing especially the big action videos where you want to sort of include these personal stories with some of the activists, you also need to be aware of like what risk you're putting them in by making content. Because what if they don't ever get arrested? What if their name isn't even disclosed? They're now on the internet telling their story about being in this action. Do you know what I mean? So it's great to have legal experts kind of walking us through that and walking people that are in our videos through that and explaining all the, you know, the risks of not just being in action, but being out there, you know, in public.
Yeah. Do you ever run across like issues of just having permits, and are there any tips you can give people in terms of how you go ahead and like, if you're going to film like that thing for the Koch brothers, did you have to get like National Park Service permits to be on the mall with cameras, or did you just kind of go down there and...
Yeah, we just kind of winged it. I do remember something else from my talk, which is, there's no segue here that I can, but I'm just going to bring it up out of nowhere, is that we've been doing a lot of work with super users on platforms like Vine and Instagram.
What's a super user?
So... let me think of a good example. We ran a project last year called Arctic Drilling is No Joke. And we got stand-up comedians to tell the worst joke they'd ever heard. And then the tagline was, you know, this isn't funny. And so isn't, you know, Arctic Drilling isn't either. And we had people, we shot a bunch of them, but we also had all these people submitting their own. And that's like, to me, the biggest way that things have changed, is that it's not all being controlled by someone in a video suite, you know, with all this fancy equipment. Like, people are making stuff and putting it out there, and they put a hashtag on it, and it's all connected. So, you know, we got... various comedians participate, they shot their own stuff, or maybe someone in their office shot it, they slapped the hashtag worst joke on there, and then we worked with a company that aggregated everything into one place. But we also did some fun stuff on Vine where we contacted, you know, people who have gazillion, you know, a gazillion followers on Vine. We got them to make, you know, so one guy made a really funny little joke of like, I'm going to file my nails. And then he took some nails and put them in a filing cabinet.
So that's brilliant.
But he has like a million followers, and he put it up. We didn't put it up. He put it up on his channel.
So you literally just,
and then we
rebinded a lot of followers and just contacted them.
I wrote to like 150 comedians on Vine and wrote to them all and emailed them all and, you know, bothered them all. And we did the same thing for our Green My Internet campaign last year, and we got some fantastic animators. We also, for the People's Climate March, worked with Jerome Jarre, who has like, at one point he had more Vine followers than anyone in the world, and he, to this day, has more Snapchat followers than anyone in the world. So he created a Snapchat story for us during the People's Climate March, and it was apparently our biggest day on Twitter ever.
Wow.
Because he came with us and posted stuff, and he's reaching people that we could never reach, you know?
Has Greenpeace experimented with any of the kind of new Snapchat meets live streaming services like Meerkat or Periscope?
We used Periscope in the Seattle action, and it was a great success. It was fantastic. I don't have any figures on it, but just personally, I was glued to the screen the whole time. I thought it was
Did
amazing.
You have the climbers actually shooting in their fence?
So the Seattle event was actually a kayak blockade in front of a rig. The Polar Pioneer was about to leave for the Arctic, and I think probably about 50 kayaks got in front of it in the wee hours of the morning, and a bunch of them were geared up with Periscope on their phones, and I don't know how many thousands of people followed it, but a lot. It was riveting.
I think I had mentioned it on a previous podcast, but I just installed it to see what the fuss was about, and I decided I'll open the person with the most views, and it was actually the Weather Channel. It was like a small crew of people in a van chasing a tornado that is touching down, picking back up, traveling, and they're chasing it in real time, and it was so strange. It's almost like FaceTime, but with a complete stranger, and it's not chat roulette. Like, it was like a real, almost intimate experience, yeah. And I didn't expect kind of the qualitative difference in how I felt.
Yeah.
Like, it was different, and just how frictionless it was. It was like, and it's live. There's, no buffering issues, and people are posting, and
it did little hearts.
It did leave a positive impact, but it did also leave me kind of, spinning my wheelhouse, figuring out, what do I do with this? it was like Twitter in the early days. You're like, well, this is cool, but, how do we use this new communications channel?
I think a couple of things we learned from it was that, you really need someone who's a good MC. That someone could, because sometimes this stuff goes on and on and on, and you need to provide people with scripts, as much as possible that they can sort of read from when there's downtime. Because otherwise you're just like, what is going on here? No one's talking, or they're talking about something irrelevant.
It's like dead air.
Another thing that I think I always find that, so a lot of times we use all of these new technologies, new platforms when we're doing actions. But to me, a lot of the times that stuff isn't powerful until it's put into context. So a video that someone sends out from their phone. I don't think, from the Portland action, one of the activists sent out a little video of him just talking to the camera saying, the Fennec's coming, we're about to, it's coming at us and we're hanging here and, the showdown is about to happen. You couldn't see anything except for his face, right? So I don't think that video on its own got tons of views. But when we sent it to CBS News and they used it along with our footage in the morning show, so here's the ship and here's the wide shot of the climbers, and then you insert this personal, and for them that was like gold, because they were like, oh my God, this footage is amazing. It's so intimate and personal. Intimate and personal doesn't mean anything if you don't have the wide shot, right? So yes, all of these new things are great, GoPro and iPhone video and Periscope, but to me, you need the story around stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna say the two messages I'm taking away from that are, you still need the traditional storytelling tools of establishing shot, introduce your character and have a conflict, and then and the other thing was video quality. In a case like that, who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all about capturing emotion and being on site. So if it was a red there, it wouldn't have really made that much difference.
It's very nice, though, when you have a red doing the wide shot and then you cut to someone's phone.
So do you find there's any difference in the quality of the productions that you guys are putting together? Like, is it less important or is it just circumstantial? Like, okay, well, this is a commercial parody and it has to look like an ad for an Apple MacBook.
We have done one of those. Yeah.
I did part of that one as well.
I love that video. It really depends. But I think
Hodgman commercials where he was the PC and
I'm a Mac.
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking about that one.
That might have been.
It was way before me.
Yeah.
No, we did another spoof a couple years ago. That was iCole. It was just calling Apple out for using, their using coal to power the cloud. And then they shifted. It was like one of these campaigns where we actually won something. It was fantastic. And they've made huge efforts to change that. But we took an Apple commercial and just spoofed the hell out of it. And we wanted it to look like an Apple commercial. So, yeah, that's when you have the rig or you have the dolly or you have the fancy camera. But I think in general, we are way more flexible than when I started 6-7 years ago in terms of production quality. Mm-hmm. It's that, yeah, people want authentic.
Right, we should probably drink for that interruption. The phone ringing in the background. Every time that we have a firehouse across the street, and every time a fire truck goes by, we cheers Charity Engine.
Cheers,
Slancha.
Thanks, Charity Engine.
But we've had no fire engines and no helicopters today. It's oddly quiet.
It is
recording.
Really? Well, I mean, we started a little.
Dog hasn't barked.
Started a little early. Give it another hour.
I'm not using a loud mixer, so there might not even be any feedback in the recording.
Talk
we're getting
a little
too professional around here.
Oh, yeah. I need more beer. Talk a little bit, though, just for maybe there's some folks breaking into this area. They're probably not going to go out, and maybe they are. I don't know if pricing structure has changed, but I was going to say, probably not going to go buy Premiere. Mm-hmm. Might be overkill. What if you were to start today and kind of wipe clean your institutional knowledge of video editing, what would kind of be the lowest barrier to entry to make a...
Premiere's
video.
Not that expensive.
Premiere?
You get the free trial version.
Yeah,
so you get
although
15
days. You know what, you couldn't just sit down.
No, I mean, I don't have the whole cloud at home. I just have the
so you
single
pay the,
app.
Because Adobe does,
I think
you can do month to month now.
Yeah,
but if you have iMovie or even Movie Maker, Windows Movie Maker.
You have an EDU email address, you get a discount at Adobe as well.
I just switched to Premiere. I absolutely love it.
What were you using before?
Well, I mean, I'm still cutting stuff on Final Cut 7, but I also cut stuff on 10.
Did you hate 10 like everybody else?
I can't stand it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whatever works, it sounds like.
I'm so happy to be working with Premiere. Yeah. It's great.
Use someone else's computer.
Well, I mean, Premiere, I mean, I'm old. Like, so I learned how to cut on a Steam Deck with a bin, literally a bin of clips. Those are these things. They're pieces of film that you hang from little hooks in your bin. and then you put them or cut them with your blade. So like everything in Final Cut and Avid and Premiere like reference these terms. Bin,
all the little icons,
blade,
and skeuomorphisms.
Yeah. Yeah, when you make a folder, it's called a bin. You know, I understand that. Final Cut 10, it all went out the window. Like it was just like...
It was a little bit too much.
What were they called? Events
soon.
Or... Oh,
yeah.
Geez. Yeah, couldn't handle it. Too old.
Conan O'Brien did a hilarious parody when that came out. Apparently they edited that show or when he was at late night. And they just cut this little video, like this fake promotional video for Final Cut 10. And it was like the sync was off and there was all these weird like, you know, color alterations. And it was pretty funny.
All right, I got to look that up.
Well, so obviously it sounds like you enjoy your work. I mean,
it's not boring.
Is it ever not? One of the things that also I think about when I think about the work I've done with Greenpeace is the fact that, you know, it's committed people and, they feel passionate and
then you get 100 of them all working together.
It can be a little chaotic. Do you have hard times sometimes just like distilling the message through the noise and getting people to come coalesce around an issue, or is it do you find yourself sometimes like, and this is not unique to Greenpeace. I mean, any organization is going to have this, but you know, everybody's got their own ideas.
Yeah.
How do you get people to kind of come together around something that's actually a smart idea and not something that's, you know, just going to please the most senior person who thought of it? Any tips?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a challenge. You know, you have all these mavericks and really, as you said, strong personalities and strong, you know, people that are true individuals, you know.
A bunch of faces from Greenpeace just flashed before
my eyes. And then you got to, yeah, and then they try to work together. Challenging. I think, I mean, we talked about this a bit already, but the biggest challenge on a day-to-day basis is translating the campaign messaging into something that people can relate to.
Is interesting.
Yeah. Because 9 times out of 10, we're making stuff not for the people in the choir. We're making stuff for the people we're trying to bring in. So, like the Snapchat experiment was great for that, because we literally reached people that had never heard of Greenpeace. And I think, you know, so in my mind, like the sort of the campaign teams here and the online teams here, online team wants to make 30-second videos about kittens, you know, and then the campaign team wants to make 30-minute videos about, you know, impacts of coal burning plants. So, and I'm in the middle, right? So I'm the translator from campaigns to online. And that's definitely a challenge, but it's a good one. You know, I like, okay, I'm thinking of, we did a video a couple years ago. We have a campaign called the Democracy Initiative, where we're part of a coalition of groups, some green groups, but also some labor groups, NAACP, that are looking at how all of our issues are related and how, you know, the Koch brothers and the religious right and they lump us all in together. They're trying to repeal solar and they're trying to repeal the Voting Act. So we got to get together. If, you know, we can't just be in our little camps. The enemy sees us, you know, is attacking all of us, and we need to unite in order to fight back. So we, the campaign team kind of came to me with this idea of like the concept behind it, but it was very dry. You know, it was all about Alec and all this wonky stuff that just made my head spin. And then I thought about it. I mean, you asked about sort of like how I brainstorm or how things happen. Lots of times I just buy whiskey for people and get them in a room. I know that like people say the brainstorm doesn't work, but I think it, for me, it always has. But in that instance, for some reason, I don't know why, but in my brain, I kept seeing this thing called an exquisite corpse. You know, when I was little, I used to do this game where you would fold a piece of paper up and one person would draw the head and like you'd start the neck on the next panel and then you'd give it to your friend and they would draw the torso and they'd start the legs and you'd give it to the next person and you unfold it and it's this hilarious hodgepodge. Kind of thing. Yeah. So I kept seeing this as an image that I really wanted to work with. And I wrote a script together with someone from our online team who, like, I think I wrote a script that sort of worked for the campaigns department. They then added a bunch of wonky language back in. Then the online campaigner came in and got rid of all the wonky language and made it really human. And it came out great. It came out really great. Upworthy ended up
wash so many times. It was coherent and
no, because I think like having her support, because she was the one that was going to be promoting it. And like I said, there's no point in like making video if you don't have someone that's going to distribute it. And she really held a lot of weight with them. They finally were like, okay, fine, we'll let you make this weird video with, you know. So we got all these people in the studio, and then we hired this fantastic animator to literally collage their bodies as they were talking about different issues. So gun rights and, or gun control and, not gun rights, gun control and reproductive health and environment and seniors' rights. And, you know, it's just like all of these issues that are important and that we all need to be supporting. Anyway, it came out really great, and we also got a ton of views, which is nice. So,
and in the end, that's all that matters.
Actually, on that, do you find yourself, I guess, has it changed in terms of the type of content you're producing? Are you producing evergreen content, or is it all about that initial bump? Because otherwise, it's going to the video graveyard, and it might get a few views, but you know, you've probably got like a 3-month window.
Yeah, I mean, it's some of both. There's definitely some videos that we still use. We made a video last year, Greenpeace and People Like You, that was the idea came from the fundraising department. They needed a video to use for year-end fundraising. But we're recycling it. In September, the feature doc, How to Change the World, is premiering. And they are allowing Greenpeace to put a short piece of content before the film. And we're able to use that film there. So that's pretty cool. We're getting it bumped up right now for the big screen.
So what's this movie you're talking about?
How to Change the World. It's about Robert Hunter and the origins of Greenpeace. And it's just covering the first couple of years in which Greenpeace was born. And it's, you know, honestly, like I didn't...
Was that done by Greenpeace?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was not done by Greenpeace, which it is great. It's really good. It's won a bunch of awards. It was at Sundance. It picked up an award at Sheffield, which is a big doc festival in the UK. And honestly, like, I didn't want to see it because I thought it was going to be really male. I thought it was just going to be
men in these boats men on chasing a boat, harpoon,
you know, and it is
Japanese
that,
sailors.
But there's also some fascinating women involved. And it's just a beautifully, I mean, the editing, whoever edited that film, like they should get an Academy Award. It is, the editing is fantastic.
Done,
and it's a universal
cooperation. It sounds like,
well, in terms of the archive, yes, they got all of the stuff from our archive, and actually my boss, Tim, helped them recover a lot of photographs that had gone missing of some very, hallucinogenic trips that were taken some little islands in Alaska by some of the early founders. But it's a really beautiful film. And I think that also, I also found it surprising in that it's a very universal film. You know, there's some moments where the founders are sitting there going, okay, now what the F do we do? You know, and it's really about personalities clashing. So you come up with this great idea and you launch this movement, but then everyone, at a certain point in the film, turns into a clash of different personalities involved and where they want to take the movement. And that's not a Greenpeace story, right? That's the story of every cause in the world.
Nor is it necessarily a story that Greenpeace wants to tell.
But that's why it's so good, is because
it's not whitewashed.
They follow, you know, Robert Hunter, who was one of the founders, but they also follow Patrick Moore, who left Greenpeace, and Paul Watson, who left Greenpeace to found Sea Shepherd. And they're totally humanized, you know, and they're amazing, engaging characters. There's no kind of, this is the good guy and this is the bad guy. They're all fascinating.
So is this going into wide release, or are you preparing for like a Washington, D.C. premiere or something?
The premiere on September 9th is going to be 400 to 500 theaters in the U.S. and the U.K.
Oh, wow.
And then it'll be showing in New York and L.A. through the fall. And I'm not sure if it's also showing in other cities. I can't remember. I think it depends on sort of how it does.
And how are you guys piggybacking on all this publicity?
We'll see.
We'll find out a week beforehand.
We'll take it. I mean, I think that's the great thing is when outsiders do stuff for us, it travels in totally different ways. So I think we're really lucky.
Yeah. Getting back to your earlier point about kind of crowdsourcing your video production.
There you go.
You look like you're about to say something, Brian.
Nope.
I told you.
So I
just have to say I'm really enjoying hearing your stories. Somebody who comes from a nonprofit background, it's a lot of fun to talk about digital strategy and this and that. But at the end of the day, I like where that meets and interfaces with the audience. And video is a very intimate form of communication in production and for the people viewing it. And so it's just, I'm kind of just sitting here in awe listening and, I have plenty of questions, but I kind of want to hear your story and your experiences and learn just more from that.
So one thing we like to ask here is if you were not working at Greenpeace, is there another nonprofit that you might like to give a shout out to as someone who you'd like other people to recognize and support?
Well, I'm going to do something very bold, especially today. I've always said, and I maintain even today, that the only place I'd rather work is Planned Parenthood. And, you know, I know they're under tremendous, they're getting so much
they've been under duress for 30 years.
Yeah, exactly.
They could use some counter video help.
Yeah. I just think they're amazing. You, do, isn't you know, yeah. I think that, I mean, for years, you know, I went to Planned Parenthood clinics all over, you know, various cities I lived in for basic health care. And, you know, people are so focused on the abortion issue, but they provide a level of quality health care for women that no one else does at affordable prices. And I just have utmost admiration for the people that go to work there every day and put up with all the crap.
You mentioned earlier that you, one of your early documentaries that you produced was an abortion rights video. So what was, is that related to your experience with Planned Parenthood or?
So I lived in Ireland for a while and abortion is illegal there, continues to be. And yet thousands of women travel to England every year, to get abortions. And I had also been living in Louisiana in the early 90s when it was, when abortion was made illegal.
So it was legal then made illegal in the 90s.
Yes. Same year David Duke almost became the governor.
Oh, I remember that year.
Good year in Louisiana. So I think I was fascinated, you know, because, it, well, the Louisiana case went straight into the courts and eventually after years was overturned. So it never went into effect. But certainly, you know, with clinics closing all over the country, you know, the pro-choice movement has just found different ways of I mean, the pro-life movement has found different ways of shutting down clinics. But it was scary in Louisiana for that brief period where we thought the law was going to go into effect. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we had some stories from places where there is no abortion? Like, wouldn't it be interesting for people here to hear those stories? Mm-hmm. And not just from, you know, the 60s pre Roe v. Wade, but like other places in the world where it's illegal. So I ended up at a certain point getting to go live in Ireland for a while and had been really interested.
Did you move there just for the documentary or you just happened to be there?
I got a Fulbright and went to make a kind of very vague, I think, what was my project? It was about women in activism or something. It was a multimedia project. It was
nothing
like,
so controversial as abortion was on that application.
Right. I don't think so. it was a multimedia project. The web was kind of new, so I did this like multimedia website where I transcribed, interviewed 50 women activists across all different issues and transcribed their interviews. And it's amazing. I still get requests from people that are researching various different topics in Ireland and want to use quotes from transcripts or pieces of the video that I've uploaded.
Is the website still up?
Yeah. I'm not going to tell you what it is, though. It's so old. But anyway, so out of those interviews, I developed several of them into short films, and one was called Like a Ship in the Night about women seeking abortion.
You videotape these interviews?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then I also did a film
on like Super 8 or something.
It was the XL1, the Canon XL1.
Okay.
Oh, I remember first time.
Remember
I saw
that camera?
It. Yeah. I think they used it in like the what was it? Real World? Yeah.
Yeah.
They had the Real World house here in DC.
Yeah.
It was because they would always run around
I still
with
have
the cameras.
That camera.
Yeah.
I use it as a deck. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I did another project about it. The Good Friday Agreement had just been passed and all of the prisoners were just being released in the north of Ireland and no one had really done a film about the women's experiences in the Republican movement. So I did another film about that.
Wow. So filmmaking is deeply ingrained in your psyche, huh?
Yeah. It's funny because I haven't made a lot of my own films since that time, and I'm okay with that. Like, I really like editing. I really like working with other people's stuff. I got to edit a really fun, fantastic documentary a couple years ago called Married in Spandex. about two women that drove from Pennsylvania to Iowa to get gay married by this crazy woman performance artist, Leslie Hall. And some friends of mine had shot all the footage, and I was lucky enough to edit it. And it did really well, and now it's on Hulu and Amazon. And last year for Pride, it was, you know, promoted as this great video to watch during Pride. And
yeah, that's an interesting point, because it's writing a book is a very solitary exercise, but making a video is like it's a fun group dynamic where, you know, you're sharing ideas and not necessarily responsible for everything as well.
Yeah.
So you like the editing part the best?
Oh God, yeah. I remember in grad school, my friend Cheryl used to leave little notes on the Avid that said, blink, pee, drink water, you know, because I'd be there for days, you know. Like, oh, I'm just going to fix this one little thing, you know, like 8 hours later. Yeah, I've almost got it.
So is there anything coming up that you're excited about that you can tell us about?
Oh, gosh.
Besides your yoga class?
You know, I have a three-year-old. I love making vines with my three-year-old. It's the perfect format for us. They're short. She's got a short attention span, and I don't have much time. So
does she know how to operate the
camera? Oh, God. She knows how to do everything. It's crazy. She does stuff on my phone that I didn't know was possible. You know, she turns everything into, like, you know, various different filters, and then I don't know how to get them off. So I'm really having fun with short format.
The shorter the better. That's the rule around here. Well, listen, it was really great to have you on. Good luck with the big feature premiere. And maybe come back in 6 months and tell us about the next thing you're working on.
Give me another beer, I might.
Cheers.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you, Charity Engine.